It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, several bills in the state Senate are aimed at improving water quality. We talk with two of the lawmakers behind those proposals. First, making fundamental changes to our democracy and society can take a lot of time and political effort. And when things do change, they're often designed, if they can be, to stay that way. But sometimes even long-held institutions do change for better or worse. Our next guest says the U.S. is no stranger to uprooting entrenched institutions, having done away with things like the landed aristocracy and slavery. And more profound changes to our society might not be far off as we contend with issues of inequality and political power. Paul Starr is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. He's the author of the book Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies, which comes out today. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Rob, glad to be with you.
Well, the core idea in your book, the first word of the title, entrenchment, what do you mean by that?
I'm talking in this book about changes at a very fundamental level that become hard to reverse. And so you can think about our Constitution, which is difficult to amend. So when a country adopts a Constitution, it's often making a certain set of rules very hard to change. But think of a constitution more generally, not just what's in a constitution formally, but other aspects of society that are also really fundamental and become hard to change. So one of the things I talk about in the book has to do with the rules of inheritance that used to maintain the power of landed aristocracies. And so those are the rules of primogeniture, for example, that concentrated all wealth in the eldest son. And that contributed to the maintenance of a very narrow class of landed aristocrats who in England, for example, dominated that country for centuries. Slavery, as you mentioned, that's another example of a system of social rules that concentrated power in a dominant class. And we have our struggles today over the concentration of wealth and power. And what I've tried to do in this book is to put those conflicts that we see today in some historical perspective.
And entrenchment isn't, as you write, inherently good or bad. It could be bad. It could be an institution like slavery. It could be something more positive like equality under the rule of law that could be enshrined in a constitution and legal codes and practice. It's kind of value neutral in some ways.
Yes, yes. The term itself is neutral. I mean, not all forms of it are neutral by any means. But yes, you can have entrenched rules that protect freedom. And you can have entrenched rules that protect slavery. Yes, they can be on both sides.
And talk about how things become entrenched. You see two paths. We might do something on purpose, like, say, write something down in a constitution, or it might evolve over time. I'm thinking of, like, the two-party system in the United States. It wasn't written in the Constitution. It came into being and kept self-reinforcing.
Exactly, exactly. So, right, I distinguish between what I call strategic entrenchment, where there's a very definite purpose. And a constitution is an example of that, where there was some thought given to making rules hard to change. But then there are other things that come about that really people didn't anticipate at the time would become fundamental and hard to change. And we have many examples of that. Yes, you mentioned the two-party system. Now, this goes back to choices about elections, about electoral rules. In some countries, Britain and the United States, we've got rules that it's called first past the post. And we have these single district elections, and whoever gets a plurality of the votes, you don't necessarily have to get a majority, becomes, you know, the elected representatives. Other countries have systems of proportional representation, and those work very differently. They have different consequences for party systems. They have actually very dramatic consequences for the distribution of power. But what I argue in the book is that at the time these early decisions were made, people really didn't have a clear idea of what the long-run consequences would be.
Talking to Paul Starr about his new book out today, Entrenchment, Wealth, power and the constitution of democratic societies. I want to read a quote from your book. Two of the big past events you focus in on in the book are, as you mentioned, landed aristocracy, slavery. Now, here's a quote. No problem is more difficult for democracies than the entrenched power of concentrated wealth. Can you talk about how you see that today as an entrenched power in our American system?
Yeah, so, you know, we have a society that is both a capitalist economy and, you know, and democracy. And the forms of wealth have changed historically. Landed wealth is not as important as, you know, industrial and financial wealth today. And as the economy has changed, it's generated new concentrations, new forms of wealth, often very concentrated, and that creates new issues. So let me give you one contemporary example. When the internet was really first developing in the 1990s, people thought it was going to decentralize power, and it would create very widespread opportunity, and to some extent it has. But in fact, the online economy now has become the basis of extraordinary concentrations of wealth and power. Facebook, Google, Amazon exercise just in, you know, this extraordinary power over our lives, the power that Facebook has accumulated. We've heard lots of stories about that in recent years. And, you know, many of us, most of us, didn't really see this coming. So as the economy evolves, it creates these new forms of wealth. And what we've seen actually going back now, you know, to the period right after World War II, we've seen actually a tremendous increase in the concentration of wealth, in inequality of income. And that has created new problems, I think, for democracy. It's not just in the United States, but in Europe, too, and elsewhere.
And you see, you write that the framers of the Constitution and other early parts of the American system were suspicious of concentrated wealth, as you said, in a different form then. But why were they inherently worried that too much concentration of wealth, our system might be allergic to it?
Well, again, if you go back to the 18th century, the concern was about landed aristocracy. It was about the concentration of landed wealth. That made sense at a time of largely agrarian society. And they're actually right. We now have a lot of historical evidence about concentration of landed wealth in a narrow class, societies that have very dominant landowning classes. And indeed, those countries have had great difficulty establishing stable democracies. So I think actually that Jefferson and others who were very concerned about changing the rules of inheritance, and this was a big issue at the time of the American Revolution, they were fundamentally right that that if there had been a kind of landed aristocracy established in America, and in the South, slave plantations were that. So I'm not saying that it didn't happen at all. But I think if it happened more generally, it would have been a huge barrier to democracy in this country. But what they didn't see, of course, they couldn't see, was the emergence of industrial wealth and how that would become concentrated. And then in the late 19th century, with the rise of the trusts and the antitrust movement and so forth, there was a whole new set of conflicts. And so, you know, this is just, it's a continuing issue in our country. It'll never go away.
Is there anything inherently wrong with not a landed aristocracy, not an industrial trust, but some people have been really successful and concentrated wealth in an internet company, say, is that inherently unhealthy for American representative government?
So I don't think wealth is unhealthy. I do think that monopoly is unhealthy. I do think that when there is an overweening concentration of wealth and power, that does have very serious implications for the ability of ordinary people to have a responsive and accountable government. So, yes, there is a point at which it becomes a problem, and that's why we need, I think, stronger enforcement of the antitrust laws. And I think progressive taxation has a real function in preventing that kind of inherited wealth from continuing to dominate a country from generation to generation.
We're talking with Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. His new book is Entrenchment: Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. Paul, I want to get into one more thread that you talk about in your book, a reaction, you say, in some ways, to concentrated wealth and power and the influence that it has, populist movements around the country, and the rise of a sort of strongman government in nations around the world. Can you spell out the connection?
Well, in some places, populist movements are a reaction against the concentration of wealth and power. But in other places, including, I think, the United States now, we see a kind of combination, a kind of hybrid, where you have concentrated wealth and populism kind of fused together. So that you have this really sort of strange bedfellows alliance of great wealth and populist politics.
Is there a sense, you think, that people feel like a elite class, sort of vaguely defined, has gotten things wrong, so that we turn to a successful person, maybe a different type of elite, to try to steer us out of it? Is that what you see spreading?
Well, I think something else is also going on in the United States and in Europe, and that has to do with long dominant groups feeling that their power is slipping away, and that has, I think, a lot to do with the changes that have taken place over the last half century in racial relations, in gender relations, that have upset those who've enjoyed positions of dominance, predominantly white men, looking at these changes and becoming fearful of what their implications are. And it's created a kind of alliance. This is this strange fusion of oligarchy and populism that we see in the United States and some European countries.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Mike on the line in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, Paul. So two events that occurred in the last 20 years that are seemingly unconnected, Citizens United, and then the reduction of the press of newspapers and reporting across the country because of the expansion of the internet, kind of seems to be coming together and influencing each other and helping to concentrate as well.
Mike, thanks for the call. So campaign finance, Citizens United and other decisions, and the decline of the media, how do you see them playing into this, if at all, Paul?
Okay, so I think the Citizens United decision is an example of how important our Supreme Court is in making decisions about how wealth gets translated into power. And so before that decision, corporations were not able to use their treasuries directly to finance political candidates. Those were rules that had existed for a century. And now that path is open. And I think that is a good example of the connection between wealth and power. Now, on the question of the decline of newspapers, that's actually something I've written about in a totally different context, and it's happening all over the country in states like Wisconsin and elsewhere, that local newspapers and regional newspapers have, you know, lost their advertising revenue, lost subscription revenue, and have shrunk. Some areas of the country are now what are called news deserts because they have no community newspapers at all. And there hasn't really been any kind of commensurate development of online news to make up for what's been lost at the local and regional level. So this is a real problem. I don't think it has the same origins. It's a separate problem. But I think it contributes to the weakening of democracy.
Thanks for the call. Going out to Tom with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi. Hey, I have a question in reverse to your concentration of wealth, but what about the concentration of debt in our society? For instance, the high $1 trillion-plus that is college debt. How does that affect us?
Yeah, so that is a different kind of problem, although, you know, it's not unrelated because, you know, if you go back several decades, college education wasn't nearly as expensive, including public universities, nearly as expensive as it is now. And so we didn't see young adults being plunged into the kind of debt that they face now. And, you know, I think if we had had different political choices being made, many young people today would not be carrying that burden. And so, you know, it is related, I think, to the changes in power that have taken place over the last several decades.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Paul Starr, author of the new book out today, Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. Paul, if we agree, if we take it as given that concentrated wealth and monopolies are bad for the American political system, but those have become, at least in some senses, entrenched, is it possible to do something about it?
Yeah, I think it's possible to do something about it. And I say that because Americans have done something about it in the past. I mean, just go back to the period in the late 19th and early 20th century when there were the trusts that, you know, dominated the oil industry and steel industry and other industries. And during the period in the early 20th century, known as the Progressive Era, we had measures taken that broke up those trusts and limited their power. It didn't, you know, we still had a capitalist economy, but there was a limitation that was put on the power of that kind of concentrated wealth. And so we have done, you know, at other periods. So I do think it's possible, and I think history should give us some encouragement.
You also worry, though, that things could change for the worst if some of the entrenched systems go away. You worry about things like constitutional conventions or one-party dominance of the court system could change things in ways that are hard to reverse. Can you talk about your, I guess, worst case?
Yeah, okay. So I am concerned about the direction of the Supreme Court. We mentioned the Citizens United decision. There are other areas, for example, antitrust and labor law, where the Supreme Court has really exercised, I think, is a very unfortunate influence on behalf of corporate power. But at this moment, things are still close enough on the Supreme Court. There was a recent decision where Justice Kavanaugh very surprisingly sided with the liberals on the court. This involves Apple, the Apple store, and the question of whether it's been exercising monopoly power. And, you know, so at this point, I think things are still open enough. But frankly, and here's, I'm going to just be clear about my own political views. I think if President Trump has a second term, he will very likely be able to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, maybe even Stephen Breyer. We'd go from a 5-4 court to a 7-2 court, and then you don't have the situation where a lone dissent on the conservative side can make a difference. And instead, I think the law would move very considerably to the right and for a very long time.
As we wrap up, from the eyes of just one citizen, one voter, these long-term entrenched historical trends can seem pretty big and hard to change. Is there something that individual people can do to turn against the tide here?
Well, it's what we've always been asked by our society to do, and that's to show up, to show up and vote, to show up and protest in some cases. That's it, showing up and doing our part. And for each one of us, it may seem small, but it is amazing what people can do when they get together.
We'll leave it there for now, Paul. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. We've been talking about his new book. It's out today. It's called Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. Coming up after the news, we'll hear from two Republican state lawmakers. They'll join the show to talk about a set of bills aimed at improving water quality in Wisconsin, focusing in particular on pollutants in well water around the state. A lot of people in different regions of Wisconsin affected by that issue. Also coming up today on Central Time, we'll continue our series High Tolerance, looking at the impact of alcohol in Wisconsin. Among other things, we'll look at rural treatment of alcoholism and other addictions, and why it's so hard for many people to find that kind of treatment. You can follow all the coverage of alcohol in Wisconsin in this High Tolerance series. Just go to WPR.org/alcohol. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Private wells supply drinking water for a big chunk of Wisconsin's population, about 25%, according to the Department of Natural Resources. And there's been rising concern lately over potential contamination of that water with nitrates, among other pollutants. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services estimates that there are high nitrate levels in about a tenth of Wisconsin's currently used private wells. Our next guests are working on legislation they say will help protect the people who rely on that well water. They're both Republicans. State Senator Patrick Teston represents the 24th District in the Portage area, and Senator Robert Coles represents Wisconsin's 2nd District in northeastern Wisconsin. Senator Teston, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be
here. And
back.
Senator Coles, thanks for coming up.
Great to be here.
Let's start with well water. Senator Coles, can you talk about the problems people are facing with nitrates in their wells? This is an issue around the state, I know.
Well, it is, and this is Pat's specialty, because he has a bill that came through the committee that I chair, and we're very interested in moving that bill out of the committee relatively quickly. It's
and
a significant initiative around the state, and Pat's been taking the lead on that.
The Senate Bill 137, I think.
That's correct. So right now we have anywhere between 40 to 44,000 wells that are contaminated with nitrate above the 10 parts per million, which is the recommended level through the EPA. So we know it's a huge problem in certain areas of the state are more susceptible to nitrate contamination. So districts like mine that are concentrated primarily in the Central Sands region where there's more those wells are more susceptible to nitrate contamination just because of heavy ag use and other uses as well. So the bill that we drafted, SB 137, creates a new pilot program housed within DHS. So currently, there is a well compensation fund that is administered through the DNR. Now, in relation to nitrates, you only qualify if you're over 40 parts per million, which is four times the EPA safe standards, and you have to have livestock in your land. So for tens of thousands of homeowners across the state, they don't qualify. So this legislation would create a new program housed within DHS. We would like to appropriate $10 million for this new program to allow homeowners up to $2,500 to receive grants to go towards either a filtration system, reverse osmosis, towards a new well, or anything that's going to get them within below 10 parts per million nitrates, which is below the safe standards. So we're excited about this. We've gotten a ton of great feedback and support, and I'm confident that we'll hopefully get this through.
And Senator Coles, what do you see as a timeline for this one piece of legislation we're talking
about
today?
Well, we've been working on a few tweaks to the bill, you know, with the author and the DNR. Senator Teston's met with the DNR and some other folks, and we're waiting for a sub or an amendment. I'm not sure either one. So in the next couple of weeks, I would think.
And some people have called in over the last couple of years since we've been talking about nitrates and groundwater. They're saying, hey, let's tackle the problem. And as they see it, the problem is high density of livestock in some places and not enough controls over runoff for those. Is that a problem you'd want to tackle separately, whichever one of you wants to jump on that?
Well, from the broader point of view, okay, you've got the nitrate problem, which Senator Teston has put a lot of time into, and you've got E. coli and sometimes some other issues. We passed a bill in the Senate just this last week that will attack the issue of runoff, that will help entities. It could be farms. It could be other – it could be municipalities. It could be golf courses. Anytime there's runoff. But the more dangerous stuff that you just mentioned, we're having difficulty really moving forward in what's called non-point pollution, and that covers all these things. And what this bill did that we passed last session would create a clearinghouse. See, under current law, a point source discharger that's facing some kind of a limitation can one-on-one deal with a non-point entity. Well, that's very difficult to go out and deal with that individual entity. The clearinghouse would be a place where credits would be collected, and then the point source entity that's facing their next effluent limitation, and that could be municipal water plants, it could be cheesemakers, it could be paper companies, et cetera, they could go to the clearinghouse and buy credits. And the beauty of this is that we would force additional cleanup, more than we'd get through just regulating the point source discharger. So this is a way, if we can get this thing signed into law, and I think we're going to grab far more pollution, more nitrates, you know, more E. coli, et cetera.
So if I have this right, if I own a golf course, and I don't, but if I did, and I did some great work reducing runoff in mine, I have some credits. I can sell them into the clearinghouse, and maybe the farmer across town can buy some of those credits. So it was an incentive for me in the first place.
The point source discharger would buy the credits.
I get it. Okay.
Remember, you got non-point, lots of different, hundreds if not thousands of different places where there's runoff. So this would be attacking it from a broader point of view once we get this thing up and running. And we'd be the first state to do this, to have this clearinghouse that would be it'd be put out to bid. So it's possible a private entity would be running it with DNR oversight. So there's accountability. They wouldn't be able to just do anything. So when, let's say, a municipal water plant is facing their latest phosphorus cleanup criteria, they would be able to go into this clearinghouse, buy the credits, but they would be getting more because we have a 1.2 to 1. Would be cleaning up more pollution than they would otherwise. In fact, it would end up being because there's the various charts that have been worked verified by EPA and DNR would require more than what is currently being cleaned up by just the point source discharger. So all this runoff will, we believe, attenuate over a period of time the E. coli and the nitrates that Pat's concerned with.
It sounds a little complicated for the user, for the non-point or the point polluter. Is this going to be pretty easy to make sense of?
I believe so. And I think one of the reasons why it's going to make a lot more sense if it gets signed into law is just given the fact that you have so many stakeholders from a wide spectrum who have come to the table that realize this is a problem, we need to address it. And what I'm really excited about is the fact that since I've been in office, you have all these stakeholders who often at times have been on opposite sides of the issue and have at times been at odds with one another. But I think what you're starting to realize and see from individuals is that clean water, it's not a partisan issue. It's not a Republican or Democrat issue. It's a Wisconsin issue. And we want to make sure that we're putting forth the best policy possible that is going to balance the needs of our various industries, from manufacturing, from agriculture, but also making sure that we are good stewards of our natural resources. So that's why I believe you're seeing so many different approaches being thrown out right now, from our bill dealing with nitrates, from Senator Cole's bill dealing with this new clearinghouse, is to really take a number of different approaches to make sure that Wisconsinites have clean water and that we have our strong natural resources right here in the Badger State.
And I'd just like to throw in, you know, the generations of effort from money put on the point source discharge, municipals and industrial. We're talking 50 years at least. We're finally seeing, great improvements in like the Fox River that runs through my district. but we haven't been able to really hammer on the non-point. Now, this isn't going to happen overnight. Meanwhile, people's wells are damaged, you know, thousands and thousands all over the state. That's why Pat's bill, Senator Tessin's bill, is so critical, because this isn't going to be fixed in 1 year, 5 years. This is going to take a long time, continual effort. And that's why you have the monies for filtration or for new wells is so important.
One more piece of legislation I wanted to get into before we're out of time, a bill that I think both of you are working on aimed at raising more money for DNR water protection efforts. Where's this coming from, Senator Coles?
Currently, the CAFO monies, a good chunk of those are diverted into the general fund. And the bill that we're working on in the committee would keep that money at the DNR in order to generate, in my case, the bill to one position. Now, we need more than that. I introduced this as to make a point that, hey, the various permittees are paying this money in. Meanwhile, the audit that we had done that's now about a year old showed that there's a great deficiency going on as far as the individuals that graduate from Stevens Point, Pat's alma mater, and UW-Green Bay, my alma mater. Mm-hmm. Those young people that work for the DNR, they don't have enough of them to keep up with the permits. And whether it's CAFOs or other industrial dischargers or municipal water plants, we need about five people. Now, there is a provision in the budget that I'm interested in following. But if we keep more of that permit money there, we'll be able to pay for those individuals that design the permits. This is at the heart of our water pollution efforts. You have to have those people that I would consider experts that know how to design permits and tell that individual discharger, you know, how it's going to be, how you're going to comply with the various standards.
So this is a fee that the confined animal feeding operation, the CAFO, pays currently. Some of the money goes into what we're talking about. The rest goes into the general fund. Now it would all go into water conservation. Is that right?
Correct. We want to make sure that we have adequate staff at the DNR to administer these permits. Regardless of whether you agree with CAFOs or not, we want to make sure that there is proper oversight, that they review these permits correctly and ensure whether or not these projects are warranted, and that we're doing our best and our due diligence to ensure that we're looking out for Wisconsinites.
And Senator Coles, this does have a price tag, because this is money that now would not be going into the general fund, right?
Yeah, it's about $80,000. But again, I did this to make a point here that, hey, these various CAFOs are paying all this money in, and then we don't have enough staff. It's like, we've got to have the staff. So in the budget, the governor asked for five positions, and he asked for some other increases. So the Fiscal Bureau and the Joint Finance Committee hopefully will sort this out. I'm trying to follow as closely as possible. The bottom line is we need about five more staff to catch up with the backlog and make sure that there's enforcement, accountability for those point source dischargers that may not be doing the right thing.
And Senator Coles, let's wrap up with you. I know you've been following and working on conservation issues in the state for a long time. Do you see an appetite for this kind of legislation in your own caucus, Democrats, and the Assembly as well?
I do. And based on the unanimous vote last week on the Pollution Prevention Partnership, the clearinghouse concept that we just talked about, mm-hmm. I see it. There's wind at our back. I think people are seeing this as a very much a bipartisan issue, and I think we're going to make significant advancements in a number of areas, not just the bills that Senator Tessin and I are working on, but I think there'll be several good things coming out of the Speaker's task force that we both serve on.
Senator Coles, we'll leave it there. Thanks for coming up to the studio.
You're welcome.
And Senator Tessin, thanks for being here again.
Glad to be here.
That was State Senator Patrick Tessin and State Senator Robert Coles. They joined us for a look at several pieces of legislation they've introduced focused on drinking water quality issues here in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Environmental Protection Agency is reportedly planning to change the way it reports the health risks of air pollution, a move that would result in fewer reported deaths each year. The New York Times says the Trump administration would likely use the lower figures to justify rollbacks of air pollution rules. The new modeling method would be part of what's known as the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, a replacement of the Obama-era's Clean Power Plan, and is expected to be made public next month. Tracy Holloway is a professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. She focuses on air quality, energy, climate, and public health. Tracy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, these reported changes center on a particular kind of pollution, particulate pollution. Can you talk about the importance of that kind of pollution and health and mortality?
Yeah, when we're talking about particulate pollution, it's really anything in the air that isn't a gas. So it can be suspended liquid or solid particles. It could be smoke from a barbecue. It could be wind-blown dust. Or it could be chemicals that are cooked up in the air from chemical reactions. And actually, it's these cooked-up particles that are most closely associated with power plants, because power plants emit sulfur dioxide, which is a gas, but that cooks up into a certain kind of particulate matter. And they also release nitrogen oxide, which is a gas, but cooks up into another kind. So power plants are a big contributor to these particles, even though we don't see the big billowing plumes of smoke like you might see coming off of a barbecue.
Now, this all centers around an Obama-era climate change action. But the side benefit they made the case was, hey, by reducing these power plant emissions, like coal power plants in particular, we're going to save X number of lives. And it sounds like now the EPA is looking at recalculating it, saying, now, hold on, you're overestimating the impact. How do you start to break that down?
Yeah, I think we're really talking about two different issues. First of all, when it comes to air pollution, the air in the United States has been getting cleaner and cleaner and cleaner. And that's really because we have effective rules under the Clean Air Act. So that's a good news story. And the way we've been achieving these reductions is by having a pretty clear approach to policy. For six common pollutants, one of which is particulate matter, there's a bright line approach where we have a threshold of what's considered good and what's considered bad. And having this kind of passing and failing approach has been extremely effective in encouraging new technologies and new regulatory strategies to make our air cleaner. But of course, we all know that there's not one magic level where air pollution switches from being good to bad. Our lungs don't have an on-off switch. And in fact, what the health research shows is that as air pollution levels go up, we have more strokes, more respiratory disease, and importantly, more premature deaths. So there's this idea that cleaner air has fewer deaths, premature deaths, especially, and that dirtier air, people die more often. And so that is something that's really a robust finding from the health research. And what the New York Times reported was that they're thinking about saying, well, if you're under the threshold, then we shouldn't count those additional improvements, which is sort of like saying if you're passing a class, we shouldn't worry about whether it's a D or a B or an A, you're passing or failing. But I think we all know that even if you're passing something, there may still be benefits from doing better.
So even if my community has a passing grade, we just sort of limboed under the particulate matter threshold, we could still be healthier by lowering it even further beyond that passing grade.
Absolutely. And that's what the health research shows over and over. And, you know, actually, the American Lung Association tackles this question head on because every year they come out with what they call the State of the Air Report. And anyone can Google State of the Air and see in their county what the grade is for their air. And they give a grade for two pollutants. One is particulate matter that we're talking about here. The other is for ground level ozone or smog. And they make the point that even counties that are passing may be getting a D or a C, or they may be getting an A. I mean, there are many places, especially here in Wisconsin, that has really clean air. So we're not saying that the air is bad everywhere, but more to the point that if our air is getting cleaner and people are getting healthier, that it makes sense to know that as part of the policy process.
Talking to Tracy Holloway from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, looking at a change along the way from the EPA and the Trump administration that would change the way we calculate the impact of particulates in our air on human health and human mortality. Tracy, somebody might look at this and say, okay, so this is sort of a bureaucratic reworking of things, no big deal. Is this a big deal?
it really is a big deal because when it comes to these air pollution rules, we spend a lot of money to get our air clean. In fact, for the amount of energy we use and the cars we drive, the United States has some of the cleanest air in the world. But still, nearly half of the U.S. population lives in areas that are above the clean air standard. And we know that there are measurable impacts on public health, from childhood asthma attacks to premature death to actually even if you get an organ transplant, how likely are you to be able to have a successful transplant experience? And all of these are related to air pollution exposure. So anything we can do that's moving toward cleaner and cleaner air is a win for public health. And there are always trade-offs, and it's good to be aware of those trade-offs. But I think too often when we're thinking about our energy decisions, we're not accounting for those air and health benefits. And what this is saying is that we shouldn't be allowed to account for the air and health benefits. At least that's the way it's reported in the New York Times. So I think that there's this question about, you know, if we don't count the benefits of something, it's really hard to know whether it's worth it to invest in energy efficiency or renewable energy or any of the emerging technologies that could make our air cleaner and our communities healthier.
You've mentioned that in general, air has gotten cleaner in the United States. How is this dispersed? Are there areas that are hit harder by particulate matter pollution than others?
Yeah, typically urban areas are have higher air pollution levels. My sister lives in Los Angeles, and every time I go to visit her, you can see the haze hanging over the city. But you can also have high particulate levels when you have a forest fire, when you have wind-blown dust. So sometimes, you know, the Southwest has a lot of particulate matter from natural sources. And across the eastern United States, a larger fraction of the particulates are coming from power plants. So a lot of the story associated with the change from the Clean Power Plan to the proposed Affordable Clean Energy Rule deals with coal-fired power plants, and that would be an especially big issue for the Midwest and all across the East Coast, where changing away from coal would be expected to make the air cleaner and have health benefits.
Would a change like this in our last minute or so slow down that switch away from coal to cleaner sources?
It's likely, yes. I think, you know, everybody wants to live in a healthy community. And when we think about what are the choices that we're making and where are we getting our energy from, if we're not even allowed to take account of the health benefits, then it's hard to know why we might be wanting to switch to cleaner sources.
And briefly, what are you watching for as this actually gets made public and may become a political rule?
Well, I think the fact that we're talking about it is a really good step in the right direction, because I'm a scientist and my goal is to get good science into the decision-making process. And when I read this article from the New York Times, what I read is that they're trying to put a lid on the science. And, you know, I think there's valid disagreements about what to do, but whether we should hide the numbers and ignore the science, that doesn't seem quite right.
Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It was a real pleasure.
That's Tracy Holloway, professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. We talked through about the Trump administration's plan that would change the way that health risks of air pollution are calculated. The New York Times says the EPA could likely use those lower figures to defend additional rollbacks of air pollution rules. The plan is expected to be made public sometime next month and go into the rulemaking process. The Game of Thrones finale, led me to double-check how to pronounce finale. Am I getting that right, J. Carlisle Larson?
Yes, it is.
And 19 million people watched it, which is a lot in this day and age. But the folks at Axios went back and found some of the most popular TV show finales. MASH, 106 million.
That's a lot of people. Good
now,
Lord.
And I went to you and asked, is there a favorite series finale that stands out to you, JC?
Yeah, so there are a few that stand out, I think. There's the Seinfeld finale, which everyone remembers. I remember watching that as a kid.
Mostly negative views of that,
yeah,
I seem to recall.
I was also a kid, but my favorite finale to the show ever was The Leftovers on HBO.
Yeah,
which
you're
was
nuts
a really,
about the show, and I don't even know
I
what
really
it's about.
I really love this show. I think it's a really beautiful show. It's based on a novel that I think went in a wildly different direction. A shout out to Carrie Coon from UW-Madison, is so good in the show. And for such a dark show, it ends so beautifully that, and it's so strangely as well, that it was really, really cool.
Now, how many seasons do we have to get through to get to that finale?
If I recall correctly, 3. But it's a dark show.
Okay. So brace yourself. Did you watch, have you been watching The Game of Thrones?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And what did you think? Spoiler free. I haven't. I bailed. People know. I've talked about why.
It was okay. It was fine.
See, people seem pretty peshy on that one.
Yeah, it was fine.
This is Central Time, hopefully a long way away from our own finale.
Yeah.